Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 139, recorded December 2, 2011. Strike the pose. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Carbonite Business, online backup for your law office. Carbonite Business backs up your computer files automatically and continually and keeps them safely off-site. Try it free at carbonite.com and get 2 bonus months with offer code TWiL. And by Ford, featuring available voice-activated Sync. Sync gives you versatile access to music, podcasts, and more from just about any device. Check it out in the new 2012 Ford Focus and at ford.com/technology. Hey everyone, I'm Denise Howell, and you've joined us for This Week in Law. We have an amazing panel for you to talk about the wacky stuff that's been going on this week, and I can't wait to get into it. First, let me introduce the luminaries who have joined us today. We've got Nilay Patel from The Verge. Hi, Nilay.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great. It's great to have you back on This Week in Law. There in your new digs.
Yeah, I can see.
We can see the verb behind you.
Yeah. Well, we're working on the rest of the letters. We're new. We have to.
That's
be,
right.
You know, yeah. We're being
a first year startup. You'll have a G. After that, the E will follow. Maybe for Christmas.
Yeah. Maybe. I'm hoping. It's a stocking stuffer.
Well, we'll put that on the list then. Also from The Verge, we've got Matt McCary back on the show. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how's it going?
Going great. Wonderful to have you back on TWiL.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I stole
Matt. And joining us again from Chicago, Illinois, and the offices of Hinshaw and Culbertson, Evan Brown.
Hello, hello. Happy Friday to you. It's great to be here.
Wonderful to see you. I think I'm safe to say that we're all really happy we are not this lawyer, Joseph D'Elia, who wrote the cease and desist letter. He is general counsel for Carrier IQ. And for anyone who is not completely up to speed on this story, in the last couple of days, I always know a news story has hit the mainstream when Fox News is covering it. And I think everybody has covered this Carrier IQ train wreck happening of the company that makes software that handset makers and wireless carriers can utilize to monitor network traffic. But what it's doing is recording the activity on the phones. And there's all kinds of controversy about what sort of disclosure, if any, is made about use of this tool. And the initial controversy, what I was referring to a minute ago, is that when, let's see, the developer's name is Trevor Eckhart. When Trevor began to dig a little deeper into what this Carrier IQ thing was doing on his own handset and began posting various information that was publicly available from Carrier IQ's manuals posted online and talking about what he thought was going on here and doing further research, this general counsel for Carrier IQ, Joseph D'Elia, sent off a fairly standard and fairly strident cease and desist letter asking that Mr. Eckhart stop what he was doing, take down the stuff that they posted. He alleged copyright infringement of the manuals that had been posted and also started getting into blustering about defamation.
Right. I mean, this isn't how you do it. So I got to say, you know, we send out cease and desist letters. I mean, people scrape our site like all the time, right? And they record the podcast and stuff that we do. And so we, you know, our general counsel sends out letters, but they're not like this. They're like very polite. They're very calm. They're very like, hey, you did a thing. It's not working out. Please do something else. They're not, you're verging on defamation and we will take every action against you if necessary. And on top of that, having this be the first response is like the biggest PR blunder this company could have ever made. I think it set them up for this tidal wave of anger that's come sort of in the past couple of days. If they had just responded to this guy and said, hey, You found our software, you found our training materials. Let's explain to you what's really going on. We prefer it if, you know, you didn't host these materials and just link to us, because we update them frequently. We don't want there to be any old stuff out there, blah, 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 blah. They would have won the community over. And they could have said, we provide this data. We don't provide this data. Talk to Sprint, who's our customer. Instead, they sent off this letter, which is, I mean, don't send this letter. I mean,
right.
You can't send something this aggressive to a community of people that is like doing research on security, because they will immediately believe that you have something to hide. And that has been the dominant narrative now, is that this company has something to hide, not they're working with Sprint to make our phones better, which is what the narrative that they have just recently woken up to knowing is the one that they have to get out there.
Right. The reason I feel so sorry for Mr. D'Elia is that the follow-up letter from CarrierIQ's CEO, Larry Lenhart, to the EFF, who immediately responded on behalf of Trevor Eckhart and said, hey, this is fair use, and there's no defamation here, and it really sounds like what you're trying to do is shut our client up. Larry Lenhart sent the most conciliatory letter expressing his deep sorrow and concern and thanking EFF profusely for representing Mr. Eckhart and the work they do in general.
Yeah.
About all he didn't throw into this letter, but you can read it between the lines. It's, we are so mad at Mr. D'Elia. And, I'm speculating as to what his job security is looking like these days. Evan, wow. Have you watched this train wreck unfolding before us online?
I did. And I mean, this is one of those things that might have even been a bigger deal if it hadn't have been for the Thanksgiving holiday that, you know, obscured a lot of the attention that it might have gotten otherwise. And, Mr. D'Elia, this lawyer's name, whatever it was he said. I mean, this letter that he sent, this cease and desist demand, you know, certainly has some problems. It's weird in the way that it looks. I mean, its format is weird. Mm-hmm. Not that that's going to somehow affect any legal significance that it could have had if it were truly based on something actionable. But it makes it. It's just kind of weird to see it in a format like this, which is so unconventional. Second of all, and perhaps even more problematic, I think that there may actually be some substantive flaws in it as well that I don't think have been addressed by any of the commentators. But this goes into the I want to say ridiculousness, but I'll try to temper that a little bit and just say maybe. Or something like ridiculousness of it. They come out, backing up just a little bit. Cease and desist letters usually have, you know, like four or five elements. And the first element is chest thumping. We are so awesome. And then the second element is, we are so awesome that we could crush you into the ground. The crush you into the ground part, and when we're talking about copyright, is usually some kind of recitation of the complaining party's rights to get monetary damages, and in some copyright cases, you can get statutory damages and recover costs and attorney's fees. And so that's where you get this magical number, and you see this in news reports a lot about copyright disputes or newly filed lawsuits. The plaintiff is claiming $150,000 worth of damages. That's the maximum statutory damages on this. The problem that I see, and this is, you know, I can't certify these results, but I did go to the copyright website and just ran a quick search to see if Carrier IQ actually owns the copyright on anything, and nothing came up. So that would suggest to me that they don't own the copyright, or that they haven't registered the copyright in these materials that have been posted on the web, or that were posted on the web and taken down, or whatever their status are, these training materials that are at issue here. And so without having registered the copyright in those in a timely manner, then they had no basis on which to claim statutory damages and recovery of attorney's fees like they did in the end. So that's one problem, a substantive problem with this that I see, that you know, setting aside the obvious fair use issue here. So it could have been researched a little bit better, I think.
Yeah, more pigeon IQ than carrier IQ.
Nice.
Sounds good. Neelai, let's get into the substance of all this. Is this just smoke, or is there fire here?
I think there's a fire, but I don't think it's at, like, in Carrier IQ's office. I think they're doing what Sprint asked it to do, and what AT&T asks it to do, which is develop software to monitor performance on phones, right? And the software has I think there's a delta between what the software has the technical capability to do, which is scary, which is it records every keystroke on your phone and every website you go to and blah, 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 and what AT&T and Sprint are using it for, which is tell us when a call gets dropped, right? And I think, you know, that's fine. We can puzzle out sort of the details there. The bigger problem is that every carrier uses a system like this, and Carrier IQ is just the dumb company that responded poorly to a question of what does your software do? What they should have said is our software does what every mobile carrier does, which is it monitors network performance on a device, right? And then they should have punted the carriers right away. So I think the little question is what are the technical capabilities of Carrier IQ software and how do we guarantee that Sprint and AT&T won't turn on the scary capabilities? And then the big question is, how do we guarantee that no one in the industry does this because they're all running similar software? And so I think there's a little bit to puzzle out there. And what Carrier IQ is actually doing right now is that they're just serving as the symbol of the problem, right? And it sucks for them because they're probably like a 12-person company. And they have it's true. You can see they have no idea how to handle the situation and from every level, right? I mean, they're not even, if you listen to Evan, they're not even drafting their cease and desist letters correctly. They're claiming things that aren't true. So I think they're kind of a bad victim because they don't seem to know how to have the right conversation. But it's really important that we have that right conversation about what data is on the phones and how it gets shared. And the mechanism, which is what Carrier IQ builds, is sort of like unimportant.
Right. It almost seems that the response, you know, you on your site, The Verge, Sean Hollister has a link to this video by Andrew Coward. What an unfortunate name in this situation.
Terrible name. Yeah.
Yes. Explaining the business model and talking about how it works. That almost might have been the better response.
To respond to these guys instead of throwing a cease and desist at them. That's never going to work. I mean, right. You know, we do have a serial registration to The Verge, right? For the, you know, we publish articles and we register the copyright in them, and I can't go to some scraper site and be like, we're going to sue you. I can't go to some kid who uses one of our pictures and say, we're going to sue you. I certainly can't go to somebody who criticizes our work and say, we're going to sue you. I can say, you're wrong, and here's why. And that is the way that you deal with, that's the larger story of dealing with copyright infringement, right? Is you can't open with, we're going to sue you for infringement. In our current environment, especially online, because you will find a million people who find ways to make your life a living hell and will tell you, A, you've crafted the substantive claim incorrectly, and B, there's a fair use claim. No matter what you say, you always hear those things, right? You have to engage on a real level before you say, okay, this engagement isn't working. We're backing off. We're gonna approach the litigation route now. And they just didn't do that. I don't know why. I don't know where in the decision-making chain of that company they forgot that that's how the world works and they thought they could go straight to a C&D.
Right.
Well, and so, you know, it's not like there's no pattern for this already. I mean, what we're seeing is the strain of using the square peg of copyright in the round hole of a public relations problem. And so that's why it's so anomalous and why it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense and why we're kind of scratching our heads saying, you know, why did it happen like this? But on a larger scale, you know, we certainly have a pattern for this. And kind of as an aside, I love the way this skit usually plays out. There's some kind of privacy controversy. Some company stumbles in some way or makes some kind of error in terms of privacy. And it's usually not 12 to 24 hours later, you have Al Franken, saying, we need to investigate. And, you know, who's the other guy? Weiler. Markey. Biz Markey and Stuart Smalley out there going, we've got to investigate these people and holding hearings and all that stuff. So I love how that plays. It's kind of like if there's some kind of woman involved in a scandal, she'll have Gloria Allred out with her the next day. It's the same kind of pattern that plays out in all of this. And so, the serious point about this is that Carrier IQ really does have a model to follow on this. If we just look back no farther than April, the similar data points on this are with, you know, remember the researchers in the UK who found the problems with the iPhone and I guess it was iOS devices who were capturing too much location information and that, you know, ostensibly could have been available to Apple. I forget how that actually got resolved. And then it was a couple days later where the Swiss researcher found out the same problems with the Android platform, this location information privacy issue. So there certainly are models to look at on how meaningfully to respond to privacy questions. And that it's very clear that the meaningful way to do that is not to misuse copyright in this way. And I'm cautious to use the word copyright misuse, because that actually does have a technical meaning that may or may not be applicable here. But it certainly is a strain on what copyright is really intended to be used for. And this ain't it.
Right. Matt, I think the issue that keeps coming up here is, okay, so we know that this is running and some of the carriers have adopted it. The handset makers seem to be distancing themselves like crazy, saying, hey, this isn't us. It's the carriers gathering this data. And so it comes down to, you know, what have you agreed to as a user? Are you comfortable that people are agreeing to the kind of monitoring that, for example, Sprint is doing?
You know, I don't even know. I'm confused by how each of them is dealing with it. On the Apple side, it's strange, because I know that they've said that the new version in iOS 5 doesn't have it. And I guess it encompasses, it's been removed from most of the devices. And the weird thing about it is that they're in a different situation than everybody else, because they have one of the upsides to having complete control over your ecosystem and your OS and pushing out updates and controlling that whole environment is that you control that whole environment. But the downside is that you're also accountable for everything that's coming in and out of it. I've been perplexed by what is it that Apple initially intended this for, and they can't hide behind the carriers when they say that, okay, so-and-so is, you know, they're putting, you know, Google can, you know, I don't know what Samsung's doing or Sprint or what they're doing with the skins or how they're modifying these things to include carrier IQ. Apple can't say that. Apple's got complete control over everything that's coming out in that OS.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I'm pretty sure it's still on the Sprint iPhone. You know, because Sprint is the only company that responded by saying, oh yeah, we use it. It's an integral part of our service. And that was their response, is not only do we use it, we can't, it's integral. And then Apple comes out and says, well, it's off of most of our products, right? And I asked them, like, is it on the Sprint iPhone? They're like, we're not releasing the list of devices. So I don't know.
So how does that work?
It's basically no comment, right? I don't know. So I'm assuming that it's still on the Sprint phone, because that's the thing that Sprint uses to gather this data. And you know, and Sprint had a good story about network performance like a couple days ago before this all kind of broke into chaos, where they said, we're building out our network. We're increasing network performance in response to the iPhone. The iPhone's a big success. You know, people have complained. The people are complaining about Sprint performance for the iPhone. And they said, well, we're building out the network using both the data that our customers are telling us, they're telling us where to fix it, and data that we're collecting from the devices, you know, from our own network. And so, you know, if that's what they're doing, that's great, right? I mean, the happy story is, you know, the network and the devices are telling them where to fix it, and they're going and fixing it. So I'm pretty sure that to get the iPhone on Sprint, Apple had to use their software that, like, makes it work. But there's no confirmation of that yet. You know what I mean? It's still very ethereal.
So yeah, I haven't watched all of Trevor Eckhart's videos, but I watched a couple, and there's one in which he is, you know, navigating on his own device and saying, oh, well, here's a menu, and it asks me if I'm consenting to this, and thank you, HTC, for making this transparent. And he's actually sort of saying, okay, so there are some people who are doing this right. You know, I've been using an iPhone for years, and nobody's, long before iOS 5, and nothing has ever asked me whether I wanted carrier IQ logging all my activity on my phone. And I, you know, I'm not comfortable. I guess I'm with the congressional Markey Smalley party that, you know, I'm not comfortable with how this is all being presented to users. Evan, are you?
That's the question. I mean, there's all kinds of other touch points for this, all other places we can look to see similar questions, you know, with the Kindle Fire. You know, I think it was just a couple shows ago, maybe even last show, you were talking about how it's not necessarily easy how to turn off the, you know, that super duper fast browsing that they that the Kindle Fire offers in order to protect your privacy interests. I mean, when we talk about these things like privacy and the ease of use kinds of questions as to how easy it is for the user to protect his or her privacy. We're talking about these things in the background of having had a conversation of how god awful it is that these things are happening without our consent. We get kind of freaked out by it because, after all, this is our privacy, and it's a little bit disconcerting, at least, to hear that your information may be gathered, and you know, a rich picture of your information may have been gathered. And so then we get so worked up and so upset about it, and so thinking, you know, something's got to be done, that we think that our devices ought to just, you know, have a little switch here on the side that says, you know, privacy on and privacy off. Well, it's, you know, it's never that simple, and it's easy to think of these kinds of settings and user preferences being, you know, highly obfuscated. So I think a lot of it has to do with what our expectations are as to how easy this should be. These are complex devices. They do a lot of different things, and information is passed in a lot of different ways. And so the ability for the user to properly implement technologies or, you know, configurations and settings to protect their privacy requires a certain amount of sophistication, and that's something that's not avoidable, assuming that it actually can be done. I mean, if this really is a rootkit kind of level kind of thing that can't be taken off, there, I said it, you know, huh. If it can't be taken off, then that's the, you know, everything I just said really is kind of not relevant, I guess.
Well, here's my problem with it. I think that people just don't, I mean, it's scary when you look at the potential. And like Neil, I said, even though there might be a huge delta between the potential for this and what it's actually being used for, there's questions about why it has that potential. And if you look at, I mean, that's been in my mind this whole time that I've been reading about this, is that I don't understand. If your concerns are drop calls, network quality, things like that, why there's the potential for even logging entire, you know, keystrokes and everything that comes in and out of the phone is really necessary. And I still don't feel like that's really been answered, other than maybe that it's just something, we just give them everything and we let Sprint and whoever else figure out what they can do with the data. We don't limit the amount of data we give to them.
Right. Ken from Chicago and IRC says that, I think this is what he's implying, that users essentially get a message from their phone that says, hi, do you want your phone to be super awesome? Click yes or no. And that's what the Fire browser does.
Do you want better service?
You brought up, exactly. You brought up Congressman Markey, Evan. He's not satisfied with Amazon's response, Ray Silk. Surprise, surprise. But I think it's probably, you know, been swamped.
Why is he Marky Mark? Why is he Bismarck?
Well, so I mean, is the answer like mandated language to explain what's going on? At the policy level, do we say, like, here's what you have to say to consumers in all caps? I mean, we do it in, you know, rental car agreements have to be in, you know, 16-point all caps. We say that's how you inform consumers of their rights, right? Can we do? Is that the answer? Is that, you know, do Markey and Franken sponsor the cell phone privacy warning bill of 2012 and make that work? I mean, I don't know what the right answer is there, because there's no incentive for them to actually tell you what they're doing. There's every incentive for them to say, make your phone awesome, press this button.
Yeah, and this is something that has a lot of political currency as well, because privacy is an issue that comes so close to our hearts and our, you know, our sense of security and all of that stuff. So it's very easy to start a conversation like this, but very difficult to finish a conversation like this. And I think that's what you're suggesting, Neelai. It's like, you know, what is the solution? There's no doubt that we all have a concern over this. And so what I've noticed is that once conversations like this are started, and Representative Markey is pretty good at this, as are many, many others in this privacy advocacy space, they'll say, here's the problems. You gave us some answers. We're not really satisfied with your answers because they're not real clear. And then where the conversation finishes, this is always the acceptable escape hatch. We want you to be accountable, and we want there to be transparency. So that's how these conversations usually end, and there's no meaningful way that I've seen to actually implement something like that. And I guess I'm being guilty of it myself right now in saying this. Well, I don't know, but there's got to be transparency, right? And is anybody going to disagree with me on that? Is anybody going to say, oh, Evan, you know, you got to be thrown overboard? But and so with folks like the folks in Congress who are always doing this, I mean, I think they're leveraging that. Sure, I'm glad they're doing that. They're doing their job, kind of, you know, being a voice in the wilderness, shouting, trying to make the path straight. as we go into the technological future. But it's a thorny type of issue, no doubt.
Well, you know, but there are. I mean, there. If you look at what the FTC did with Google Buzz, if you look at the agreement they just did with Facebook, I mean, that is meaningfully transparent, right? There's you have to submit to an independent audit of your privacy policy and your actual practices every 2 years for 20 years, right? That's meaningful. I mean, that's the FTC taking actual action, you know, to maintain a level of trust, because they're saying, you know, you lied to your users. Your users don't know what to expect from your privacy policy. We're going to start auditing you. Now, I'm not saying that that should be the baseline standard, but there can be another standard, right, that isn't, you know, audits every 20 years, but it can be like a requirement that, you know, the language around collecting user data has to be X. And, you know, there's a mechanism for validating whether that is true or not. Because once you start messing around with collecting user data, I think you should be held to a higher standard of care. And I think it's pretty easy to legislate that standard of care. I mean, it won't be like pretty to do it. I think that'll be a pretty messy debate over what carriers can and can't do and what other companies that collect data can and can't do. Because that, I mean, that goes down the road of, well, what if I want to start an entirely new kind of service that, you know, is Facebook 2.5? You know, it's like, you can't, it hampers some level of innovation, but I think that's an acceptable price to pay to say to consumers, like, your stuff won't get shared, right? And I think that's like the real conversation that we need to have. Like, what is the standard of care and how do we legislate it appropriately?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think there's a footnote to that too. I'm glad you brought up the Facebook FTC settlement and them joining Google in 20 years of privacy policy assessments based on their past perceived transgressions. I think in this context where we're talking about phones and devices where people are used to taking in information in very succinct little chunks, that the information that carriers are getting across to users has to come through in that kind of way. So I don't think that the big, you know, 10-point all caps type necessarily is the solution. I think it's, you know, how you get the message, when you get the message, to ensure that it's actually understood and digested by the person using that device. I think there has to be attention paid to that. Anybody else have anything on this before we move on, Matt?
No, I just, I mean, I think some of these things are clear. You can't, I mean, logging entire keystrokes and everything that you do on the device is never going to be acceptable. Most people would agree that you'd be able to pass on drop calls and things like that. So, I mean, some of it's really complicated and some of it's just not. So, I mean, they clearly were at least had the potential to do a lot more than anybody would find acceptable.
Evan?
No. At this point, I would just be making stuff up, but that would be nothing new, actually.
How about you, Neelai?
I just hope it goes away. I think Matt can attest to this. My entire week has been blown up by like carrier IQ explosions. And like I've had conversations with Matt, like trying to like do like actual work that are like, hang on, I have to deal with another carrier IQ.
So something else happened.
It just calms down sometime soon.
Yeah, it was tracking him, he said. Yeah.
Well, I want to get into another instance of copyright being used for a purpose that may be only tangentially related to protecting the person's copyrights. And we'll talk about that in a minute after the break. First, I want to thank Carbonite Business for sponsoring This Week in Law. If you're backing up your computer files with DVDs or external drives, your law office or your other office is taking a big risk. Now more offices are backing up a better way with Carbonite Business online backup. With Carbonite Business, your computer files are backed up automatically and continually. Your files are kept safely off-site. Prices start at just $229 a year, and it only takes about 10 minutes to get started. So I need you to go try Carbonite Business for free at carbonite.com. You get 2 bonus months with offer code TWILL. That's carbonite.com, offer code TWILL. And we thank them so much for their support of This Week in Law. Okay, Evan, copyright in an unconventional way is being used against Hunter Moore, and you personally have done that for a couple of clients, as I understand. Hunter Moore is the guy, now I'm going to warn you all before I say the website, who is behind a site called isanyoneup.com. Don't go there if you're at work. Don't go there if there's a child around you. Don't go there if you do not want to see really graphic nudity, because that's what's there at that site. And if you've not been there, it's sort of a revenge porn site. We've talked about it on Twill before. What the purpose of the site is people have been texted pictures when they've, presumably this is the standard model. Folks have been romantically involved. They've been texting each other steamy pictures. They have an unamicable breakup, and the injured party decides, well, shoot, I have these steamy pictures that my terrible ex sent me, and to get back at them, I'm going to send them to Is Anyone Up? And the site then puts them side by side with their Facebook profile, assuming they have one. So matches them up to an actual name and identity. And there are these very private images out there for the world to see. Evan, you've actually represented some folks successfully in getting stuff off this site.
Yeah, thanks for the clarification, because you scared me at first, thought maybe you had actually seen me on the site. So,
yeah, no.
Yeah, this is a really, I mean, it's a very provocative site, no doubt. I mean, it takes the idea of nudity on the internet to a new level it's kind of a new twist on this, a new phenomenon, taking nude photos of people and associating them with an identity online, and that being the thing that draws people to the site. And it's a relatively new site. I think it's been up for less than a year, and just in the past couple of weeks, it's really gotten a lot of attention, both in the mainstream media and you know, bloggers and others. You know, Kashmir Hill wrote a great piece on it right before Thanksgiving about it, kind of doing an interesting take on it. And so there are, it's an obnoxious site, that's no doubt, and its operator, Hunter Moore, who, you know, every time I say his name, I always put it in air quotes because I'm highly skeptical that's his real name. he's pretty public about talking about the site. He'll gladly give an interview, gladly, go and talk about it with people. And the tricky part about this is it's all user generated content, I guess. I mean, most of it, at least, is user generated content. And for that reason, it appears to be Hunter Moore's position that he's protected by Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act against any lawsuits that somebody would file against him or the site based on the tortious harm, you know, the type of harm that has resulted to that person from having been submitted to the site. I mean, the easiest answers, and this is one of the things I was talking about on the Fox Chicago piece a couple of weeks ago, was, you know, I mean, what's happening here is people are suffering emotional distress. You know, they're being harassed. This is, you know, probably invasion of privacy. And so going after the site, it's pretty problematic because this is, like I said, it's user-generated content. People are submitting this. But the thing that makes it a little bit different and makes you wonder whether Section 230 would protect the site, and I guess I should back up again just a second here. Section 230 is a provision in federal law. It's part of the Communications Decency Act of 1996 that says, I'm paraphrasing and summarizing, no website operator will be treated as the publisher of information content, you know, that's provided by a third party. So he's saying, you know, people are just sending me this stuff, putting them on there, and I'm just publishing what I have. So if you want to come after me, I can, this Hunter Moore, he can claim that kind of immunity, that kind of protection. I think it's a really intriguing situation because, you know, he may be right for a lot of that stuff. He certainly is not publishing the photos himself. You know, he's not generating them. But my question is whether he's doing so much in the development of the site, in the way that the site is set up, and the information that he requires, and some of these statements that he makes to everyone outside of the operations of the site, if he has developed the site in such a way, if he's made it in such a way that he actually becomes an information content provider himself, if he has taken enough of a role to actually develop the content, because he actually requires a name be given with the photos, and he requires that the hometown be provided as well. All of these things are our pieces of information, when put together, are seem to be perfectly designed to harm someone's reputation or to cause harm to their emotional state. So there was a case in 2008 from the Ninth Circuit, the roommates.com decision, and that court held that roommates.com could not claim the protections of Section 230 for developing a website that made it so that users could easily express a discriminatory preference as to who they wanted as a roommate or someone to rent their apartment in violation of the federal fair housing statutes. So this site has some similarities to that, in as much as Hunter Moore has developed the site in such a way that it's designed to be a reputation and harming type of, it's essentially a machine built just to harm people. That's all the tortious issues. There are a bunch of interesting copyright issues as well, but I'll kick it back to you, because it's there's a lot to talk about here.
Go ahead, Neil. Were you going to jump in?
Yeah, the copyright issue to me is really, it's kind of like, well, who took the picture, right? Isn't that that's the first thing that you've got to figure out. So if I take the picture of myself, then I have the copyright. But if somebody takes a picture of me, then they do. So in every case, you've got to figure that out first, right? And then you've got to figure out if there was an implied, when you send it to somebody over a phone, that's sort of like an implied license to copy it, right? You've sent them a copy. You've created a copy that is on a device that can create other copies, right? It's like, it's this very like strange thing. It's like, who owns the copyright in the end, and what is the recipient of a photo you send them? Like, what rights do they have to your image, right? Because if you send it to a phone, they can do all this stuff to your image on the phone. Right, and you could probably make a fair claim that if you email me an image just for me to look at, like, I don't have the right to send it off. But if I just send a picture of you that I took, like, I can do anything I want with it, and you have to go into another body of law, into defamation maybe, to get that removed. And I don't know how you do that in the DMCA model of like takedown, right? If you didn't take the picture, because I don't think you can, right? I mean, am I getting that wrong, Evan?
Yeah. Well, I've represented a couple of clients who have appeared on the site, and in the first instance, the site was, this was back in the summer, and the site at that point was hosted on Amazon servers, AWS servers, and so we just sent a DMCA takedown notice to Amazon, and they complied, and the page came down. Since then, Hunter Moore has obfuscated the location of the actual server where the site is hosted. It now, if you run a trace route on it now, it drops off at this company who, if you contact them, they're saying, oh, we don't host it, we just provide these IP transit services. So it's more difficult now to send a DMCA takedown notice to the hosting provider, because that's hard to track down. That's something that evidently one would need a subpoena to find out exactly where the site is hosted.
Can you send it to, so, is anyone up?
Well, he doesn't listen to this stuff. I mean, he's very renegade when it comes to this, which I think makes him a direct infringer in all this stuff. You've got to remember, mm-hmm. the DMCA is supposed to be toward the intermediary. There's no question that he's a direct infringer. So why don't even think about the DMCA when I think of sending a notice to the site itself? But the theory is, clearly before we sent off a DMCA takedown notice, we carefully consider whether or not the client, the complainant, owns the copyright in that. And I think it's very clear it's the standard kind of shot you see on the site. They're either, somebody holding the camera out at a distance, taking the photo of themselves, or then there's the famous, pose where they're looking into the mirror and kind of holding it at chest level. That was, I think there was an Anthony Weiner one like that. That wasn't Anthony Weiner. That was the other congressman earlier in the year who had to resign because he posted that ad on Craigslist. Remember that? Yeah. I think his name was Lee.
Vaguely.
From New York. New York somewhere. So anyway.
You have a scary ability to remember naked photos, Evan.
Yeah. I love the facts of law.
Yeah.
So in any event, I think there's no question that the person who's taking the photo of themselves owns the copyright to that. And I think it's just extremely bogus for the recipient of that, who's gotten that through a text message, to say that they had an implied license. I'm not dissing you, Neil, by saying this, but I just think it's It would be ridiculous for them to argue that they had an implied license then to publish that on the web. I mean, give me a break. These are if you look at these factually, these are always situations where, you know, there's usually an intimate relationship or at least a hookup where it's not, you know, intended to be, you know, something that's for the whole world to see. Otherwise, they, you know, wouldn't have, you know, made it. I mean, the context is always going to dictate that these are intended to be private. And so the further publication, the further distribution of these things, to me, is a clear infringement. And if it appears on the web, that's unauthorized, and you're perfectly entitled to send a DMCA takedown notice. Now, one other quick point here. Even though it's more difficult to get the stuff off of isanyoneup.com to actually get in the site, get the content taken down. I mean, it can be done, and if anybody wanted to file a lawsuit, I think they should. But what I have done for both these situations as well, and this is something that's effective, and I would encourage people to think about this, is the real harm sometimes is the identity being linked, and the fact that if you type a person's name in Google, sometimes, you know, isanyoneup.com has such good page rank, it'll show up pretty high. And so one of the first few results that you'll see, especially if you have a kind of a distinctive name, is a link to where the person has been posted on isanyoneup.com. Google will comply with the DMCA takedown notice, and I suppose Bing as well, and Yahoo. And if there are any other search engines, let me know. To take those down those results because they link to infringing content. There's a section of DMCA section 512 that actually addresses the responsibility of information location tools. That's a fancy way of saying search engine. So that's one way that copyright can be used, ameliorate some of this harm, not all of it, but a notable portion of it.
Yeah. Neil, I just wanted to jump in and say, I'm not ready to buy into what you were saying a moment ago about the license that you might be granting by texting someone a photo.
Well, I think transport there is really interesting, right? So texting, mm-hmm. I buy, if you send it on like Facebook, like mm-hmm. that's kind of like interesting, right? I mean, like, I agree with both of you. I don't think anybody's thinking that they're granting implied licenses. I'm saying, like, as an argument, it's a really wild one that you could make, right? Especially if you get into the different forms of transport. Like, if you send it over Twitter direct message, like, you could argue, well, that's sort of an inherently public thing. And, like, there, you know that, like, these things fly out there. I don't think it's right. I'm just wondering Evan says that, you know, they carefully consider who owns the rights. So I think that's the first step. I just think it's very, like, there's a lot of nebulous stuff here where people don't know what they own and what they don't own. Particularly when they send photos from phones directly to another person, right? Where there's a lot of, like, what if I do a screen cap of a FaceTime, right? Like, that's really wild. Like, who owns that one? Like, mm-hmm. I don't know the answer to that. And I think there's just a lot of stuff with the creation of these types of images and sending them over different kinds of transport and different services that sort of opens the question of true ownership to them. And I'm just riffing here, but, like,
maybe
I think that's
Carrier,
like,
IQ owns that one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, I had a really interesting conversation just recently, total tangent, about FaceTime, about how encrypted it is. And it came up again yesterday in the context of Carrier IQ, because FaceTime is end-to-end totally encrypted. There's, like, multiple transport key swapping. So, like, it is about as locked down as any communications transport on your phone, which I think is really interesting because Apple just built it and they, like, haven't told anybody how to use it. And I think one of the reasons is the security.
And FaceTime. I thought you were talking about Chat Roulette. I'm glad you mentioned Apple because it finally set me straight.
Again.
Is that even still around? Is Chat Roulette even still around?
I think
I'm
it
on
is.
It right now. I agree with everyone. I was just riffing about the implied licensing. I mean, that's like way out there. But I think there's a lot of this. The first question has to be, like, who owns this picture and, like, where does it come from? And that's the only way.
For years, people have argued that, you know, you posted that online, so you must have been granting a license in it. And that's shot down any number of ways.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that. here, I mean, people are probably screen capping this right now and putting it on. Is anything? I could just take off my do right. one of these. Sure. Wait. Go ahead.
I don't know. Was that okay? Was that the? You got to ask Evan if that's the right pose.
I wish there were a way we could call the show that.
There you go. It's got to be at least 3 feet away from the chair. There you go.
Strike the pose.
No.
All right. Well, we have some patent stuff to get into and also Groove Shark in a minute. But first, I'd like to thank our second sponsor for the show, which is Ford, featuring Available Sync. Sync's entertainment features enable you to access music and podcasts from most devices, including iPods, mobile phones, tablets, or flash drives. And with Sync, with My Ford Touch, you can play videos or display photos from your digital cameras or portable game devices when your vehicle's in park. It's all made possible through a versatile media hub, which supports a convenient variety of devices for your music and entertainment, such as wired connections from just about any device. USB ports, SD slots, and RCA jacks are all supported. Or you can have wireless access via Bluetooth for Bluetooth-enabled devices. You just connect up your devices and they play. Once your device is connected, you can use Sync's voice activation feature to play whatever you want. Just a few of the simple voice commands are play genre, rock, play artist, and play track. So with Sync, with My Ford Touch HD Radio, you can also do, and I have wanted this for so long, iTunes tagging, which lets you tag a song that you like on the radio, and then later you can transfer that to your iPod and purchase the song directly from iTunes at a later time. How many times have you been driving around listening to the car radio? I always feel like I've journeyed back to 1960 when I'm listening to my AM, FM car radio. And there's something, you've missed the title of the song, you have no idea what it is, but you really like it and you want to reference it later. Well, now with iTunes tagging with My Ford Touch HD Radio, that's all taken care of for you. Sync's versatile entertainment features are available in the 2012 Ford Focus, and you can learn more about this and other technologies Ford is bringing to its vehicles at ford.com/technology. Thank you, Ford, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, folks, let's talk about Groove Shark for a minute. This seems to be the company that is making all of the recording industry's allegations come true. There's some big smoking guns here in the form of emails from its chairman, Sina Simantob, if I'm pronouncing that anywhere near correctly, that have basically validated, there's a lawsuit pending now, and the emails that were attached as exhibits are saying that, yeah, let's build this business and use all this unauthorized music for free and gather all this information and data about users. And then we'll be able to go to the music industry and say, see, look, we've got all this wonderful information and data for you, but you've got to license your music to us or we won't be able to, you know, help you out there. Matt, you sent this my way. Do you think this is significantly different than sort of, say, the Grokster case that we saw happen a few years ago?
I don't know, some of the implications of it on the copyright side are outside of my my wheelhouse, but I was just shocked and amazed by the, I don't want to say balls, the boldness of this, and in some ways the ignorance for someone to actually document these things. I mean, it's insane. But it happens all the time. I mean, people think that, you know, when they're writing something internal to their buddy or their coworker, that it's just something that no one else is ever going to see, so they can say whatever they're thinking.
Right. And, good object lessons here on this week's Twill. Don't text your body parts, and if you're going to infringe copyright, don't memorialize it in email. There you go.
Yeah. In this case, we had
Mr. Simantob saying, in our case, we use the label songs till we get to 100 million uniques, by which time we can tell the labels who's listening to their music where and turn around and charge them for the very data we got from them. So
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, that goal of 100 million uniques is an insane goal, first of all. Mm-hmm. So like Spotify has 10 million active users, right? They've been at this for how long? And they're like totally blessed by the labels. They have the deals. They have the marketing. They have the, you know, now they have a platform. 10 million active users. So this guy is saying, we'll just run under the radar stealing stuff until we have 10 times more users than Spotify, at which point we'll be cool. And like, mm-hmm. that makes no sense.
Yeah.
Like,
no,
like just on its face, it's like, you didn't think about that number is like bonkers. Like you can't do that. I don't know why you think that's a valid business model.
Maybe he was rounding.
Yeah. He's rounding from like 1 million to 100. Like that's what he was.
Exactly. Evan, do you think these guys are going to even put up a fight?
Well, who knows? I mean, do they have the resources to put up a fight? All I know is they were talking. There was an email with the venture capitalist that was, you know, I think one of the pieces of that was one of the exhibits to the complaint was an email where they were, you know, yapping about the. And, you know, this really is not that unique of a phenomenon. I don't think doing this, this being, let's somehow exploit this content, let's generate interest in it, let's get a user base, and then let's extract a bunch of metrics out of it and information and then make that useful as a selling point. And then, you know, we'll thereby be powerful and all of that stuff. So the thing that seems to really set this apart is the brazenness of it and the fact that, you know, it's a playbook, it's a page right out of the Grokster guys' early days. It's a page out of the playbook of the Grokster guys' early days when they were writing emails about this stuff. Like, you know, we're going to be the new Napster and all this stuff. This is really just saying, hey, you know, look, you know, we haven't spent a dime in paying royalties, or, you know, the labels don't know anything about this or whatever. So that seems to be the thing that really makes this bad. But then again, you know, we've got to be not too quick in going down the path of thinking that this kind of exploitation of content like this is always bad. It's always good to, you know, channel a little bit of Stefan Kinsella once in a while, who, you know, might very well be as bold to say as, you know, copyright should not exist at all. You know, he's an intellectual property abolitionist. We've got to be careful not to always have as our starting point the fact that the exploitation of the intellectual property rights of another, and the other being the big content industry in this way, is always bad. There's some innovation going on here with these guys, these Grooveshark guys. They're doing something. They're actually putting a layer of meaning and a layer of monetization on all of this content that is being shared by users. This is a really rich opportunity to throw all kinds of buzzwords at this scenario. You know, they're leveraging and monetizing the social layer and content consumption. There's all kinds of room for looking at the value of curation and all that stuff and making some kind of value out of that. And so there, before we are to indict and from an ideological standpoint what Grooveshark is doing here, I think it's worthwhile to carefully consider what part of us in our desire to indict them is that coming from? Is that coming from a presupposition that may be erroneous that the big content labels should have the exclusive rights to be the one to exploit their content and extract licensing fees at every turn of the turntable?
Yes, and you're absolutely right. And in my particular case, the indict motivation is coming solely from the silly use of email. So
you're right.
Their business model simply deserves further consideration and you know, maybe they do have a legal foot to stand on here.
Yep.
Let's see. There was something. Evan, I just wanted to say it seems to me that there's an opportunity here. We saw in the last story, Anderson Cooper put Hunter air quotes Moore and a couple of folks who'd had women who'd had pictures of themselves up on his site on his show. So, you know, I think there's an opportunity for a tech Jerry Springer where we get, you know, Universal Music Group and then let Grooveshark in there and let him throw.
Oh, he sat with them? Quote unquote.
Yes. Yeah. If you go to Cash Hill's blog, the not so private parts, she has the link to the video in her story about this, and it's pretty amazing how you were talking about boldness a moment ago, Matt. It's pretty amazing how he can sit there on the same couch next to the women that whose pictures mm-hmm. he posted, and they're asking him, you know, what are you doing here? What's your motivation? Is it just to make money? And he, with a straight face, goes, "No, it's to get information out there."
Yeah,
that's
an artistic endeavor. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, Matt, speaking of endeavors, there's been much going on down in Australia regarding Apple and Samsung. You want to tell us what went on there?
Wow. Yeah, there is. Well, it started out, I guess, I'm trying to think of kind of where to start with the story because there's so much that has happened down there. But essentially, right. The big news was that they, you know, for a while, since October, I think, maybe earlier, Apple's had an injunction against, part of it was voluntary initially against the Samsung Galaxy Tab 10.1. Part of it was voluntary, then the court extended it and actually came up with a ruling that they're equivalent to a district court judge, their federal court judge. And she, so immediately after that, Samsung appealed it to what is essentially a full bench of the federal court. So it's some more, it's kind of like the same tier, but it's a way to appeal up to a kind of like an en banc type thing. And they, from the very beginning, I guess, even from the hearings that they had when Samsung and Apple came in to try to Samsung tried to overturn the injunction, seemed pretty they didn't seem pleased with the lower court judge on the injunction. It felt that, that too much was sort of put aside and balanced in Apple's favor, because we all know with these preliminary injunctions you have to weigh kind of the party's interests as part of it. So really the fact that they infringe, whether the patents are invalid or valid, is one part of it, but then they also have to weigh all these other factors. And it seems like the court really felt like the factors weighed more in Samsung's favor than it did for Apple, and they also questioned some of the infringement findings. They still don't seem to feel like the patents are invalid. It's not even a patent. It is a patent. These are software patents on, I think there's two of them on various touchscreen and gesturing type things. It's not the design patent like we have in some of the other cases. Mm-hmm. But they seem to think that the infringement evidence wasn't sufficient enough, so they were willing to say, you know, that was Apple's burden. Apple really had to come on a preliminary injunction because it's an extraordinary measure. It has to come with some real good evidence in order to get us to believe that they infringe and in order to get this injunction in place. And so they used all of that and they kind of put together and mixed it up in a pot and they came out with the they overturned the injunction. But on that note, they also kept it in place until Apple has sufficient time to appeal to what is their Supreme Court, the High Court in Australia. Which I understand is a lot like our Supreme Court in that they don't hear cases. They have the choice whether to hear this on appeal, and they don't necessarily hear cases that don't have big kind of policy ramifications. And my understanding is that this probably doesn't have a lot of policy ramifications in Australia because it comes down to kind of just an evidentiary thing and whether or not they really prove their case to get an injunction, not so much some change in the law or something really unique to patent law for this case.
Right.
So the injunction is in place now. They've extended for another week, so I think it's in place till sometime in next week, and then 9th, I think, and then after that we'll have to see what the High Court says.
I'm glad you clarified, Matt, because when you said that their Supreme Court is a lot like our Supreme Court, I thought that you were going to say it's different than other courts because it has sour cream and tomatoes. So,
yeah,
Denise has heard all my jokes before. I'm sorry.
That was a new one on me, I think. Okay. Neelai, you posted on this earlier this week and said we might hear something more from by Friday from Apple.
So that's what Matt's saying. They extended it for mm-hmm. another week, and it's okay. Like, well, do you want to cover an extension? So we might put up a post saying they extended it, but it's we've got to figure out, like, you know, they've got to figure out whether or not it's going to be appealed. And I think I'm with Matt. I from everything I'm getting, I don't think that their high court is going to take it and say we're upholding this injunction. I think they'll say we'll let them sell it, and if, you know, the patents are found to be infringed, they have to pay a royalty and take it. What's the harm to Apple, right? It's like, you have 99% at market share, like, around the world. Like, what's the harm? They're going to sell a slightly different Galaxy Tab that isn't selling in the first place. Like, it's fine. You know, I'm pretty sure the court will just say you have to pay a reasonable royalty if you win the infringement case. I mean, that would be like a pretty basic answer, right?
Yeah, I don't think there really is much. I mean, I think in a lot of these cases, it's hard to find harm to Apple for a preliminary injunction just because of their stake in the market. Although you can argue that, you know, that would possibly shift greatly. I don't think the Galaxy Tab 10.1 is going to kill the iPad in the market myself, but some people might. But one of the, I mean, it's a good point because the judge actually said, one of the judges during the oral hearing for the when Samsung was challenging the appeal of the injunction, actually came right out and said, sarcastically, I don't think this is going to bring down all of Apple in one fell swoop or something like that. Something really sarcastic like that to Apple's attorneys. So I don't think anybody's really seeing this. I think in order for Apple to win, they really needed a absolutely strong, solid infringement that just made it look so completely bad for Samsung. And it sounds like they didn't quite do that in this case, because this was a more complicated case, so the evidence needed to be more clear, because we're talking about software patents. We're not talking about pictures of design patents next to products, and that's easy for people to understand. If you're going to start getting into the nuances of how software works on an infringing device, you really, really need to figure it out and make sure the judge understands. So it sounds like they just weren't convinced.
Right. And, I'm pretty sure, I don't know if this is exactly true, I'm getting the sense that, Samsung and Apple are after each other in like 50 venues around the world, right? And I'm getting the sense that all, the balance of who's winning where in the world is kind of like straining like credulity in these other countries. Like, I'm pretty sure like the Australian High Court is like fairly offended that they're getting this because Samsung and Apple are in a global fight, and now all the attention is placed on them. But tomorrow it'll be in Germany, and the day after that it'll be the ITC in the US, and the injunction in the States will take all the attention away. And it's like they're basically like waging like this world war, this world IP war against each other, and they're causing like cost to legal systems around the world when they really do need to just figure this out, right? And I'm pretty sure I'm getting like the vague sense that that is starting to come through in some of these decisions, where it's, we're not going to sit here and do the dirty work for you so you can run off to South Korea next time to get the injunction that you do want, or run to Germany, or wait for the PI order in America to come down. It's, you have to figure this out because this is a bigger problem than the Galaxy Tab 10.1 being on sale in Australia. And that's like, it's kind of the vague sense I've gotten from a few of the stories around.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. I mean, when you need a huge flow chart to follow all the actions pending worldwide, something's getting out of control. Or maybe they should have an iOS or Android app to be able to track all the cases.
I'd definitely buy it, because I spend nearly every day discussing this stuff with Neela, and right, we get confused all the time. We look at like, okay, was that a software patent? No, that was a design patent. No, Apple filed that case. Samsung, I mean, it's crazy.
Yep. Well, for anybody who thinks that's a good idea, I have a good tip of the week for us all. Or I'm sorry, this is our resource of the week. And there are a couple of iApps available from Oyez today. The Oyez site has done great audio of U.S. Supreme Court oral arguments for a long, long time. And they do have two different iApps. One of them is called Oyez Today, and this is free. And it's for people who just want, the current news on what's pending in the U.S. Supreme Court. It's got media coverage of the cases. It's got information on the justices. It's got updates on oral arguments. Just, if you're looking for the newsy stuff about the Supreme Court, this is the app for you. And then there's another one called Pocket Justice, which brings the Supreme Court and all its past cases into your iPhone. So you can actually do research with this second one, Pocket Justice. And I first heard about this over at Justicia via Nicholas Moline. So thanks for that, Nicholas. These are great resources. And then our tip of the week goes hand in hand with not talking about your extortionate and potentially infringing business model in internal emails, and not photographing and texting your body parts around. This is, don't enter into contracts with a couple that you kidnap and expect them to honor them. This was on Boing Boing, and originally at Lowering the Bar. And a gentleman, well, not so much of a gentleman, Jesse Dimmick, he sued a couple. He was fleeing the police. He drove over one of those police barricades that pops your tires right in front of their house. So he ran into their house and he held them at knife point. And he promised them that if they helped him get away, he would They said they'd help him get away, and he said he'd pay them a lot of money. And so, you know, as soon as they fed him some Cheetos and Dr. Pepper, and they watched Patch Adams with Robin Williams. And I don't know how you fall asleep after eating Cheetos and Dr. Pepper, but maybe the Patch Adams did it. He conked out, and of course they immediately went and got the police. And then he had the temerity to actually sue them and say, hey, you agreed. You guys were going to, you know, help me out here, and then you reneged. So, yes, that sort of agreement is not going to be enforceable for any number of reasons, including that you cannot contract legally to do illegal things like harbor a fugitive, and any contract made under duress is not going to be valid. So, don't worry.
You see, his big mistake was suing him for breach of contract. I mean, yeah, of course, there are these arguments that you can make about duress. I don't know. You know, is the subject matter of the contract illegal? Who knows? But what he should have done is sued him for negligence, like some kind of premises liability. Because, you see, when they let their guard down and let the police at this guy, he got shot in the back. That was perfectly reasonably foreseeable that was going to happen, and they took on a duty to protect him from that. So it's not a contracts case; it's negligence. That's where the guy messed up in his lawyering.
Oh, was it his lawyering? I was going to ask that. Was he pro se? I assume.
Yes, of course.
I want to meet the lawyer who agrees to represent this.
Oh, there! I guarantee someone would. I just know it.
Have him call me.
Well, actually, on that note, I can do breaking news on Twill here. Are you ready? The first specious class action lawsuit has been filed against Carrier IQ. It's sitting in
a taco suit, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah,
this might have a little bit more.
Well remembered. I forgot. That was awesome. I forgot about those. In Missouri, on behalf of Aaron Janik and all those similarly situated, against Carrier IQ and HTC, which is hilarious because not against Sprint, who is the actual customer of both Carrier IQ and deploying the software, but whatever. Now the first one, I actually, when I was talking to Google about this, like on Monday when this first was breaking, I told them that I was counting down the days until the first ridiculous class action lawsuit, and I guess it was false. Which is
there
pretty
go.
Amazing.
Are you surprised? It seems like this took way too long. This has been
Al Franken had two letters out in 24 hours. You think an army of taco suit vendors could be the taco truck guys could be?
That's funny.
Get your suits here. I like it. Well, Neil, I thank you so much for cluing us into that and for joining us on the show today. We've been thrilled to have you back. Wonderful comments and discussion.
Yeah, I always enjoy being on the show. And it's funny, you know, I got Matt here from the same publication. I feel like we're not allowed to be on the show together anymore.
I know, you've been on twice now. Yeah. But before, you weren't at the same publication. So
no, it's a big love fest, yeah.
Kind of cool.
Having Matt at The Verge has been just awesome. Because, you know, I'm not a patent lawyer. I was faking it for years. And so having Matt with actual like knowledge and experience to help me do this stuff has been great. And Matt, I know he was talking about how long it takes to like write in the voice and stuff, but he's been awesome. So high five, Matt. You're a cool dude.
Thank you. You're not so
great.
Bad,
and
so.
Yes, you guys will be getting my Yenta bill shortly.
Yeah.
Matt, thanks so much for joining us as well.
Thanks. No, it's a blast. This is actually where I first met Neil. I was on the back in April when
next to hiring everybody. I'm hiring. Yes, I'll be hiring Theo. Evan, you're next. Denise, you're coming. Everybody.
Oh, I don't know. We'll
scout.
Verge and Twill on Anderson Cooper, and we can all throw chairs.
That'll be great. Yeah. Then I'll do one of these. You can't see me. I'll do one of these.
Yeah, exactly. The pose.
No, I see. That was too awkward. You got to hold it really casual.
You got to flex.
I'm going to go practice, guys. I'll be.
Yeah.
Evan, you're about to get some really weird emails from me, Evan. Let me know when I'm doing it right.
That's cool. I'm always up for weird emails.
Yes. All right. Well, don't forget to go over to The Verge and check out more from Matt and Neelai. And you can also follow them on Twitter. Neelai is at Reckless over there. Matt is at iMacAZ. And Evan on Twitter is Internet Cases.
Yes, that's me.
Yes. And his Internet Cases blog was recently one of the really wonderful 100 best blogs recognized and honored by the ABA Journal as they do annually. Internet Cases is on there this year. This isn't your first year on there, is it?
This is the first year I have made the blog 100, and I'm so delighted and honored. It was great to be on there. I mean, I've been telling everybody, you know, there's at least 99 good blogs on that list. So I'm really happy to have made it, and thanks for giving it a mention.
But there's only five of them that are IP.
It took them this long. Only five on IP.
Yes, yeah, so five or six on IP, and it's him and Pat and Leo. It's a good company.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a great company. The whole list this year is really good. I'm impressed with how they did, so go check that out if you haven't already. The blog, that's BLAWG100. And check us out on Twill every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific, 1900 UTC. We love to have you watch us live. I love to have you get in touch with me between the shows. I'm Denise at twit.tv. You can also find me on Twitter. I'm D Howell over there. I'm on Google+. We get wonderful comments and suggestions. Jared Reimer, who's a great listener of the show, who always sends me stuff, was one of the first people to tell me about the Carrier IQ stuff when it all started to break a long time ago now, it feels like. So thanks to all of you for sending stuff in for the show. We really appreciate it. It's invaluable for us. And we love that you listen and watch. So we hope you'll continue to do so. And we'll see you on the next episode of This Week in Law. Thanks.